general concept that I'm talking about. One is an awarded area that's been authorized for sole or joint use. And if an area is not awarded, it is unawarded. If an area is terminated, it is no longer awarded. It becomes unawarded. If an expiration occurs and it is not re-awarded, it is unawarded. How's that confusing everybody? In other words, there's only two things. It's either awarded or it's unawarded. And so I think, going to Ken's point maybe, that if it is unawarded, it would include all areas regardless of how it got unawarded. And it may have never been bid on, so it becomes unawarded.
Right.
We're talking an unawarded area, and again, so we're all on the same sheet of music. We're talking about a combination of UCUs that have been designated as a guiding district or guide resource or whatever we end up calling it. theoretically, you could have unawarded areas that would have high populations and diverse populations of big game that if 100 guides that were authorized to hunt in that GMU, they'd all pioneer like flies on honey. I don't think you're going to see much of that because as soon as an area becomes unawarded, and if it's a good area, somebody is going to be bidding on that area. Another where there is one complication though is, let's say we had an area that had been awarded, and when it was awarded, the Big Game Commercial Services Board said, okay, let's just say it was a joint use area. And let's say in this area they said three guides could operate in that area. Now, the real question to me is, what happens if that does become unawarded? The Big Game Commercial Services Board has said three. The reason three are in there, three allowed, was, you know, back into, quote-unquote, farming that resource a little bit, protecting it.
Chairman, can I respond?
I don't think he's done yet, Ken, but you can as soon as he's finished. He's thinking.
Well, yeah. The unawarded, once it became unawarded, I guess I would question, does that take the lid off of the number of people that could hunt in there? That's what I think we need to kick around here. And I think I know the answer, but I want to see what Fanning said.
Fanning, you're on.
Yeah, well, I agree with what Lou said at the beginning. The beginning half of this conversation was there basically are two types of areas, awarded or assigned areas, and unawarded and unassigned. And I guess my point originally in this is that I think that we should take a task force position and make it fairly clear, if it's our opinion that if an area is unassigned, it's open to any guy who's licensed and qualified for that unit to be hunting there. And it seems to me that's the way it ought to be. It seems to me that in the old system, that's the thing that assured anybody up until it was over that they were available. As long as that this process has gone through once and all the units have been identified and put up for bid once, whether or not people terminate, expire, or areas are not bid upon, they should be available, so to speak, over the counter to get back in the process to be bid upon again. But in the meantime, they should be open hunting areas. Otherwise, you're going to end up with very large areas of the state closed to guiding hunting, which puts a lot of pressure, more pressure on those specific areas that are already assigned. So I agree with Lou, to me, that there should be two categories. One is awarded and one is not awarded. It's my opinion that the non-awarded areas should be just as it is today. If an area is not assigned to somebody, it should be open to hunting.
Ken, that's exactly what we decided last time, and we haven't done anything to change that. How do you feel like we changed that from our decision last time?
Well, it's not clear in here, Janet. It just says unawarded and expired, and it doesn't say that those areas will be open
middle part.
Okay, Matthew says it's on page 6, last sentence, and page 7, middle part.
All right.
Paul.
Well, that's fine.
Okay. And Ken, I didn't mean to cut you off. If you still want to talk, you can. Otherwise, Lou wants to talk.
I just was wondering, Ken and Paul, anybody else's feelings, though, on that one exception, the area where you have awarded one, and for whatever reason, it is not reassigned, say, 4 or 5 years later, and then what is our agreement on a task force on that? And under the circumstances where the Big Game Commercial Services Board has said, okay, in that area, I'll just use an example, three people can be authorized.
Go ahead, Ken.
Okay, that's the area where I want to get to, that it's actually a little later on in page 4 or 5 or 6 or something in your outline, wherein, and I would have a great objection to the Commercial Services Board determining a number before they even know who the applicants are. And so that was, and the task force, of course, earlier had said that the game board couldn't do that, or the fish game couldn't do that, which is a pretty big deal. And it seems to me that in this application process, in the whole process, that the board, the Commercial Services Board, is going to be better equipped to determine the number once they see who the applicants are. If all of the applicants are only for sole entitlement and only for dull sheep, and only you're going to take one hunter a year, then that's a different than if all the applicants are for multi-species, for joint use, and for several species. So I just think that the order needs to be changed. So I don't think you ever have the situation that Lou's talking about if you don't predetermine how many guides. And I don't see how you can if you don't know who the guides are that are going to apply.
Hello.
Madam Chair, we've been round and round on that one, I guess, Ken. There are certain areas where I think the Big Game Commercial Services Board, I was just talking to an individual here at lunch today about this, that guides, sheep guides, and in the area where he hunts, if you put more than 2 guides in there, you wouldn't have very many rams left, because there's about 6 of them standing on a mountaintop, and you give it 3 years, and so there's areas where, depending on the species, they may want it, not for biological reasons, because we got a full core regulation in that area and it's not going to hurt the population, but for a guiding quality hunt reason, limit the number of guides that could hunt that area. And all I'm saying is that if a determination was made by whoever that a lid was going to be put on a number of guides in a joint use area, if that were ever done, the question that I wanted to raise was if that area became not assigned or unawarded, would it fall into this open pot for everybody that's licensed in there, or would it just sit there waiting for the next annual reauthorization with that lid on it? That's, if we could answer that question, then we maybe discuss all that other stuff again.
All right, comments. Steve?
We have a check and balance here because of the registration process. If all of a sudden hundreds of people start applying, registering, you can have discretion to stop it at some certain point. So if there is, if there are 3 spaces, 2 get taken, and then only a few people start registering, and you feel like they're not taking 10 each, you're only taking a couple,
yeah.
Well, then you're okay.
That's over the counter. Okay.
Have you got that discretion?
Over the counter registration.
I forgot about that.
Right. I was going to say that later.
Bob.
My old friend Ken made me real nervous what he just said there, and I'm sure he didn't mean it that way, but I hate to have anything on record that indicates that we would make any kind of consideration of the number of permits to be issued depending upon who the people were, because we obviously cannot design a system that is geared at the characteristics of individuals. We can, as far as the characteristics of how intensely they intend to hunt or other things, but not who they are.
Well, obviously Bob knows that what I meant was if a guy walks in and applies and says, I want to take 200, another guy walks in and says, I want to take 40 hunters, I don't care who the individual is, it's a difference in the amount of harvest level and the number of guys. You could put 20 guys that only took 2 animals in the same area that you put 1 guy.
Ken, thank you for the clarification. We're all reading from the same music now. Further comments on page 4 before we move on? Hearing none, page 5. Page 5 is the applications are taken. What happens? And this is section 3, starting on page, the bottom of page 7 of your narrative. Richard.
Madam Chairman, we heard comments from some of the federal officials this morning, and we've heard it at public testimony that it's everyone's desire that the paperwork be minimized in all of this. Perhaps we could hear a little bit from our colleagues in the federal agencies what specific items might need to be included so that the applications and information would not be have to be duplicated on their own forms down the road, thus simplifying the process for all the agencies as well as the applicants.
Any member of the feds, it seems to me, would any member of the federal government like to address that issue? Yes, sir. Please come forward. Sir.
I'm John Kurtz, the Fish and Wildlife. You need to push the button?
Just as long as you push it forward, John, and to speak. You're all right.
Basically, what we require on special use permits is the guide, how many assistant guides he's going to have, if he uses an aircraft, identify the aircraft, what type of airplane they're going to use, what type of equipment they're going to use, where they're going to have their base camps. That's the type of information we require on special use permits that we would issue from a federal agency. Some of that level of detail probably for the application purpose probably wouldn't be necessary on the state side, like what kind of an aircraft and what the end numbers were. That's of no meaning, but it is for the land manager for enforcement purposes and so forth. You know, who's out there, is it the right person, that type of thing. So there's going to be some difference, but I don't know how you can resolve that.
You know, I've got a couple of ideas about that. Number one, we do, and we're going to get to that in our sheets here, we do have a requirement that within, I believe, 90 days of getting your permit, you have to be licensed to operate wherever you're, in whichever area you're going to be and follow the federal regulations. But furthermore, maybe there's no need to put it in our statutes, but in the application process, if the federal departments would like to sort of make an introduction to applicants and just on a few pages of paper tell them that if they intend to apply for hunting on or guiding on federal land, that these are going to be some of the things that they're going to have to be able to do, then at least when they apply, they'll know that they're probably not going to get approved if they don't have A, B, C, or D. And we don't necessarily have to put it into our regulations because we're trying to regulate both federal and state land, but maybe just as a guideline to applicants, that might be a way to solve the problem.
That could be, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be a part of the legislation.
Exactly.
Right.
Further comments on that issue? Yes, sir. Please come forward. Forest Service.
Madam Chairman, Leo Peeler with the U.S. Forest Service. The recommendation that Steve just brought up makes a lot of sense as far as how to get the agencies to coordinate with the state. I would just like to make the board aware that about a year ago, the federal government was sued as far as violation of our Paperwork Reduction Act, and trying to develop new forms through the federal government system would really be difficult to accomplish. If some form was developed, routed around for comment, we could maybe give information and insight into what may happen. But trying to get it as an interagency form would be extremely difficult.
Hey, any comments on that? Any further comments on page 5? Hello?
A couple of questions.
Okay, hang on, Ken. Hang on. Luke?
Madam Chair, on the summary report, the narrative, page 5, at the bottom, Steve, where did this 9 months come from? besides gestation period for certain animals.
Where are you again?
Page five, last sentence.
The designation process may be regionalized or divided in a manner that ensures a significant portion of the state will be covered within 9 months, and it goes on to say the remainder will be within 2 years of enactment. I'm not even sure what.
It might have come from some of the discussions that we had about how long you thought that it would take to get this done, but I'm not exactly sure where Bill pulled that out of. You can ask.
Since the Department of Fish and Game will probably be right in the middle of this, we've stated that we could get the maps and all that stuff done in about 2 years since
right.
We just started, and we intend to do that. This is a separate issue. This is implementation of the system after enactment of the legislation. That's what this means. So, assuming that the legislation were enacted in the spring of 90, that would mean that in legislation, by the first of 91, a major portion of it would be out on the auction block, so to speak, right?
You said you could do that last time.
Yeah, I think that those were your projections.
Yeah, no, our projection was getting the maps and all that stuff, implementing it within 2 years. Yeah. I'm just trying to make sure this would match with what we have said, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud. Would it match with what we've said?
I think there's one possible concern, and that's with the Commercial Services Board, that they have to go through a public process notification of adoption of those maps, which is what we talked about earlier this morning. I don't know exactly what that would entail, as a public notification period. I think we should look into that.
I think that the 90 days, I believe, was
Bill's
projection of how long things would take. I think at the last meeting he talked about a certain period of a certain number of months for stage by stage. It would take a couple of months of this and a couple of months of that, and I think that's how we got there on the 9 months.
You just rang a bell, and that's where I disagreed with him, because I told him this wasn't spacecraft we were doing here. I'd like to propose that go to at least 12 months.
What page is that?
I think we went through this before. We all want you to do it in 9 months or earlier, and so do the feds.
But we're telling you it's got to be realistic.
Especially the feds. I think that was one of our concerns as well.
Yeah, that's a major concern.
We kind of have to do something within 2 years.
I wish I could count on my fingers and toes at the same time. See, not an enactment in March.
So you do that over there at the side, and we're going to be on page five, okay? Comments on page five. Randall?
Yeah. Would the application not also have to specify the units that they're applying for? It just says, whether it's sole or joint, terms, and species, and numbers. Don't we also want them to indicate on the application what?
It says, ADF&G,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I just want to make sure that.
That's just a summary.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
We don't
want
to fill the whole page.
But that's good. But that's there's no problem with Randall double checking that. That's good. So Bob.
Madam Chair, my apologies if some of these things I'm bringing up are the result of my not having been here. You've already covered, but I'm still troubled a little bit by this numbers, species and numbers. That is the number of amount of game that the guide estimates that he is going to take. There's nothing legally holding him to that figure, is there? So he could say he's going to take 100, he could say he's going to take one, and what he did take may have no bearing whatsoever on that, except I wonder if it had any bearing as far as the diligence requirement that you have elsewhere. Now, how far off does he have to be undiligent in not meeting that estimate?
Mike Navarre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the bottom of page five that Lou was talking about, and I guess I wonder what a significant portion is and how that's going to be defined. Is that as much as they can get under their constraints of time and money?
significant portion means to me over half.
Well, if we have a couple of attorneys here who probably could argue that for days. Either we define it or we leave it vague like that, which I think if you leave it vague, it gives the department more discretion. At least if they end up in a lawsuit, they can argue that what they put out was significant.
So you're for leaving that term there?
Well, I'm just saying that this is a problem term legally.
Okay.
I guess the problem is, what if we do define it, as you're saying, and we don't get there, then we have a big problem.
Right.
And this at least allows them to try their best and get as far as they can.
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, that gives the department more discretion, and I'm in favor.
Okay. We're back to page 5.
Sure.
Ken Bennett.
I just have a couple of questions on it would seem to me that both A and C, solar joint use and species and number, I guess I understand, I don't understand how, if the applicant doesn't know if it's going to be a joint use area or if he has a potential area of sole, but I don't understand why anybody would ever apply intentionally for joint use. And I'm wondering, on the page that delineates it a little bit, it says that you can amend an application, but at least I don't have that amendment process. I guess I would have trouble figuring that out in advance. And relative to number C, as Mr. Hinman suggested, I think many of us have been doing this business for a long time, and we'd be real remiss if we were trying to predict more than a year in advance the number of species that we were going to take. Obviously, one of the advantages of having a 5-year and then a 10-year, 15-year deal is that you've got stewardship management oversight, and if your population is such that you can reasonably harvest 4 animals, you do that. If it's so you can take 6, you do that, and if it's down, you back off to 1. So I don't understand, I guess, the significance of, or how somebody would know, the answer to A or C, if those things are going to be utilized in any way in the award criteria, or maybe they're not going to be utilized. Would somebody clarify that to me?
Okay, Ken, the way I see the solar joint use thing, can't you visualize a situation where 2 registered guides or outfitters might want to go in together on a unit? Say one only wants to do 20% of the business and his partner will do 80% of the business, or 60-40 or even 50-50. I mean, they want to go into the unit together. Or the unit is so large that maybe Fish and Game decides, or the Board of Game decides, that there can be 25 animals taken in that area and somebody only wants to take 5. And so then that leaves it open for someone else to take some. Or it's just too big of an area and no one person has the capability right now to take all that's available. So I can see lots of examples of joint use.
Madam Chair.
Randall?
I would like to suggest that we leave up to the CSB what it would like to see in the application. I don't think, usually in legislation, all it says is that they will, you know, submit an application on a form developed by the board itself. And these issues that we're discussing here about species and terms and solar joint, and what areas and stuff, that really can be done by regulation, or is usually how it's handled. I would hate to see us cluttering up the statute about what the application has to have, so if we want to change the application, we'd have to amend the statute.
Chairman, I guess I almost agree with Randall. Good.
Chair, I agree wholeheartedly. Let the Commercial Services Board decide what goes on the form on the application.
This is Steve Prado. I think we had discussed at other meetings how important it might be to give the department as much knowledge as possible in advance of who's going to be there, what they intend to do, how they intend to pay for it, how many they intend to take, and what kind of use they want to do before they go in, so that there can be decisions based on as much knowledge as possible before things are cut up and spliced, etc. And I'm not trying to argue with you, but I think I'm trying to put down the reasons why these are here. We wanted the application process to be complete so that before determinations are made, there's a full knowledge of who's going to be there and what they're going to do.
Madam Chair, I don't think I'm arguing that that's not exactly correct. I'm just saying I don't think we want to put in the legislation all this detail about what needs to be in the application. There may be even a lot more questions than this. I just don't see us spending a lot more time on this particular issue.
Nick.
Yeah, Madam Chair, again, Steve, I don't disagree that this needs to be on the application. I just don't think it needs to be in statute.
Sure.
Lou.
I move to remove this out of here and let's get off of this. How do you do that?
Make a motion. What do you want to make your motion?
I make a motion to remove A through C and have it read licensed guide outfitters make application fee, start make application to the appropriate.
On a form prescribed by the commission.
There you go, whatever Randall says.
Okay. We have a second to Lou's. Matthew has seconded Lou's motion to strike out A, B, and C under Part 1 and have Part 1 read that a licensed guide and outfitter make application fee.
Make application.
Make an application.
Make application on forms.
On a form.
What was the rest of it, Randall?
Prescribed
by the Commercial Services Board. Discussion.
Question.
Any objections to that motion? Hearing none, motion's made. A, B, and C has been deleted. Number one has been reworded. Any further comments on number five? Page 6.
Madam Chairman, I got a comment on number 3.
Ken Fanning. Page 5.
This is really just the process, right?
Right.
Step 1, step 2, step 3, and I think that's correct.
Ken?
Let me make sure my understanding is correct of what I think I hear you saying is that the Commercial Service time based on the specific applications in front of them. Is that correct?
And any new information on resource status or whatever, that's correct.
Everybody's shaking their heads, Ken. Everybody agrees with that.
Okay, good.
Do you have another problem on page 5?
Nope.
Page 6. Oh, Nick. I'm having trouble getting to page 6.
Just whipping right along here, and I don't want to get lost in the dust. We're working on award criteria on page 5 of this outline. Is that
no, we're working on applications. We haven't gotten to award criteria yet, but I'm almost ready to get there.
I'll get off of here.
All right. Hey, Representative R.
Yeah. Madam Chair, on the bottom of page 5, number 4, where Commercial Services Board establishes a weighted point system to evaluate and rank the applications. The system is fair to new entrants, so I'm optimistic that that will happen. And I just wanted to make a comment there that we're just going to have to wait and see how it works.
If it doesn't, we're back in court.
The board sunsets, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Page 6. This has got to be the most important part of this, is the award criteria. And these are the 9 things that we talked about. So what you need to think about are there any more? Is there expansion of any of these? Are there Part A's and Part B's? Are there delineations? Paul.
Well, I got one concern here. Back on the thing we just passed, we've got included in this boroughs as well as municipalities. And on down the bottom, we have application must hold and acquire within 90 days authorization to conduct activity on land within the area. My concern is at some point in time, we have guides who are not only going to be dealing with Forest Service or whatever, they can also be dealing with getting an application or getting some kind of approval from a borough. And I just, I hope that we are not going that far. I hope we're just looking at this land ownership. You know what I'm talking about. I've got a real concern we could be layering this thing up. I can see a borough easily coming out and saying, hey, we want these guys to apply. We want them to pay 3% sales tax and everything else. And my understanding going through this whole process is that we haven't lighted any of the things like boroughs. What we've looked at mainly is land owners.
Boroughs own land.
Yes, on the land that they own, but they also, boundaries go way beyond the land that they own and is on lands that I can see they want to, they could have, you know, say they want, are we going to require people to get approval from boroughs if they're within their boundaries?
My goodness, this is a new issue.
It is a new issue, but it's very, very scary.
I know of just one example where this would have tangled this up with a borough where the DNR did a lease to a guide, and the borough came when he applied for a building permit for his on his lease that he had already acquired from the state. The borough said, "Okay, we have an ordinance that says you can't build anything that would support a sport hunting operation." It could tangle it up, and through a zoning ordinance made it impossible for this guy to comply.
Okay, I think this is a really good point. Steve White, we need you to put on your lawyer hat here, which you probably have never taken off, and if you don't know the answer to this question off the top of your head, you'd have to do some research on it. Who wants to restate the question? Paul, Pete? Paul?
Yeah, I just... All through our process here, Steve, we've been basically looking at people who own land for authorization as far as hunting on, taking hunts on, and getting approval prior to taking hunts on, and also with giving 90 days after you've made your applications. But in our public process back here, we've included in this boroughs and municipalities, which in a lot of cases do control activities within their boroughs, but are not landowners. And I guess I'm hoping that we specify in 7 that it just say landowners and not land managers. There's a big difference. I don't want to have, in other words, Steve, I don't want to see the guides having to go through a borough process. And the boroughs are getting more and more involved in these kind of things all the time. And Juneau just passed the mining ordinance that includes the whole doggone borough, yeah. Even though you...
I don't know if legally we can exclude the boroughs if they are a landowner.
Not, if they're a landowner, that's one thing.
Well,
but
they're
if
government.
You can't stop them. You're trying to say that we, through our legislation, can stop them from
No. I missed my point.
Oh, yeah, you can. Entitle.
You don't
want
to require
them.
Is that what you want?
I don't want to have to get a borough permit. Whether they, if they own the land, that's one thing. But if they are in control of the land, or feel they are in control of the land through an ordinance or otherwise, I don't want to have to see the guys get a borough permit.
But what if...
Plus a Forest Service permit.
What if you get the permit... If you get to be to hunt in a certain area and guide in a certain area,
and it's on borough,
and it's on borough land, and they don't let you do it.
Okay.
And 90 days passes, what should happen?
Okay, on the chunks of borough land that they actually own, I have no problem with. But the chunks of land they don't own, the Forest Service, for instance, own, but they have control of activities within, commercial activities within, I don't want to have them get a separate permit for it.
But if they tell you that you can't operate there, then what should we do in that situation?
If they don't own the land, I don't think that they should have the authority to require you to get a permit. Or should we require the guide to have? That's all. It's real simple in my mind. I get them a lot.
So the question is whether we can specifically prohibit a local government from denying somebody's right to use their concession here.
No. My question here is that are we going to require that the guide have permissions from before we issue them a ward? Are we going to require them to... Are we including boroughs in our list of authorizations here? And up here, we've included them involved in our setting up our game management unit, and then down here, I just don't want to see it transferred down that they have to get prior permission from a borough before they...
So you're saying basically if we make them get the permission, then they're going to go to the borough. The borough's going to say, wow, why don't we regulate these people and make them have special permits, etc.
That, or somebody could miss the whole point. I could go ahead and just get a Forest Service permit. Somebody else could go get to the Sitka Borough and get a permit from the borough to hunt in there, and they may establish that to be the case. And we don't specify here that it's just the Forest Service that you're requiring me to get a concession lease with. So you have a concession lease with the borough and with the Forest Service, and so you got two applications there, one with both and one with just the Forest Service. I'm just saying you should be dealing with the Forest Service.
Why do you want to cut out the borough in this case?
Oh, just the layers of work, Steve. I'm towing a file cabinet behind me in the woods to do. Richard.
Paul, if I understand you correctly, then you're really getting at the wanting just to hold the necessary permits and licenses from land owning agencies rather than entities, whether they be governmental or not, that would control or regulate or tax the activities of the guide within a geographic area of jurisdiction. Is there a language that we can add in here to get that intent that would satisfy your concern?
I don't know. I just know it's a concern. Scary.
Madam Chair, on number 7, could you just put applicant must hold or acquire within 90 days authorization from the landowner to conduct activity on their land within specified area?
This is Madam Chair, Ken.
Gene, your voice has dropped.
Sounds to me like we could do that. Would you restate that? Forest Service representatives back here before we do that, though. Go ahead.
The applicant must hold or acquire within 90 days authorization from the landowner to conduct activity on the landowner's land. And that's the point. Actually, what I think Paul is pointing to, though, is really more relevant to number 6, because if a borough, if we've got a statement that says that you have to have permits, and if a borough requires a permit, then you're going to have that. That's what
again, to me, it's the whole issue is not necessarily irrelevant, but it's not going to matter. If a borough has a legal right to require a license or a permit, and if the guy does not get that, then they're going to be out of luck. But it,
unless we require that they can't.
Unless we, exactly. I mean, if there is a legal basis for being able to do that, then even if the guide outfitter was awarded the area, they could not access the area. Or if they did access it and were found in violation, they'd lose the area anyway. I know what Paul is talking about, but I don't know if it's in the purview of this task force to try to stop that from happening. I don't know how we could stop it.
Can we hear from the Forest Service?
Let's let the Forest Service.
Yeah, this is Leo Keeler with Forest Service. I would just like to make the board aware that several of the boroughs are starting to look at government permits as a possessory interest and starting to tax that interest. We have described to them that they do not acquire any interest in the lands. They remain federal lands. But through the borough statutes, they are taxing similar type uses to what you gentlemen are talking to here. So it is worth looking into and trying to decide which way you need to go.
Thank you, Gene. Bob Hammond.
I think it's important to note that regardless of the boroughs, like other municipalities in the state, do not have powers over fish and game, that is, over hunting. So they could not limit hunting per se. They obviously could limit a business such as guiding. And if we try to put in legislation, I sympathize with what Paul's saying, but if we try to put into legislation something to limit the power of boroughs in this respect, I think we're really biting off a lot more than we can chew. Furthermore, unless the borough presently has on their books a requirement for some type of a permit, license, or registration or something for that business, there would be nothing that the individual would have to comply with.
Mike?
Yeah. My gut feeling is that the municipalities, boroughs, wouldn't really have a very big problem with trying to limit through a permit process unless you try to take away their taxing authority, which I can't imagine the legislature doing in any of them. So, but it might be possible in legislation to, because the state does have jurisdiction over the management of game, to not allow them regulate whether or not hunting can take place within the borough.
This is Lou. They cannot regulate that right now. But
right.
And Bob, all they could do is do it the back doorway, only for commercial guiding. They could just say, if you don't get a, like in Paul's case, if you don't pay this tax or get this license, get this permit from us, you cannot guide within the borough. He could still hunt himself. He just couldn't guide within the borough, if that was ever a situation. Any more discussion on this point? Steve?
I guess one of the things that I see, which is why this is in here, is so that we know who's allowed to do what. I mean, the scenario that I can see to address what you were saying is that somebody does everything except get that permit. They effectively can't guide there, and they don't tell Fish and Game or anybody that they can because they haven't gone through it. What happens to their permit? They keep it even though they're not doing anything? This is a way to ensure that not within 90 days, you told us that you can do it.
You know, it seems simple. Seems easy. It's just that you start layering this stuff up for the person out in the field trying to do something. It's just another major layer as things get more complicated. And I just hate to see that we look at that as a major contributing factor of whether somebody's going to be awarded an area or not. And all I'm saying is that it shouldn't be a factor. I would like to see it taken a step further that the borough assemblies are not going to be determining who's going to be the major awarders, who's going to get awarded in their area. And I can see that happen. To me, is basically saying to the department and to the Commercial Services Board and everybody else, you may have one thing to say, that we are going to have the final say. I have a rough time with that, that's all.
Nick?
Yeah, I think that it's a real valid concern, because if I go to a new borough that's just been formed, like, let's say, the Lake and Peninsula borough, for example, it's not even a year old, and say, yeah, I'd like exclusive guiding rights in this borough, what do you guys think about that? and they say, well, you and about four other guys are going to be able to guide Miss Burrow and nobody else. How does that relate to our UCU program?
This is Lou. If they do that, it'd be some major court battle, I'm sure. I'm not saying they couldn't do that, but I don't think we're mixing apples and oranges here.
Yeah.
One is whether a borough or anybody else has authority to manage fish and game. And under the state constitution, state law, no one but the state of Alaska has that authority in terms of managing population of game. With various ways that people control access to their lands. Well, private lands right now, as we all know, under certain conditions, private landowners can control access, and the federal government certainly controls it on federal land. Maybe we ought to just somebody for some words we can put here or something to maybe get off this, and even though it probably won't matter, to put it in legislation, I think is... I think we're beating up a dead tree on that one. It's not the intent of this task force to have the borough issue licenses or to guys. Mike?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I expect that the borough might be able to charge a permit fee to anyone operating. I thought that we can. That's probably going to happen, but I don't think that they can restrict who's going to get those permits. I think that also when we write the legislation up, if we're going to have a finding for purpose legislation, we probably will to define what we're setting this up for. We could put this in that section to say that this system is being set up as a management tool, and that would maybe help preclude or at least protect in a future lawsuit against a borough or other government trying to exert some jurisdiction.
Task force agreed to the finding section in our report to the legislature and include language like Representative Navarre just stated. We do it that way instead of trying to write it into legislation. Anybody opposed to that idea?
Mike, would you then restate what it is that you'd like, any language you can think of so that I can kind of put it down here?
Actually, I'm not sure how the language would read, but in the findings and purpose section of the bill, you would just articulate that the reason this system is being set up is as a management, or at least one of the findings and purposes is as a management tool for the state management of games, so that you reinforce the jurisdiction of the state and take it away from any of the other local government authorities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That what that it would do is just emphasize something that's already law. I would also, in the findings, I think the idea of emphasis being on land, like the normal land managers, federal and state, local in those cases, and then the private landowners, like we've talked about, corporation land and everybody else. I mean, they certainly can require permits and use fees and everything.
Yeah, we have this 90-day time requirement. Was this researched with the people that issue these permits in terms of that being a feasible length of time? In most coastal areas, you have a coastal zone management review process that's easily a 30 to 45-day process all by itself.
And Nick, I think if you'll recall, Ken, our last meeting, we agreed, just like you said, that most people would have their authorizations probably before they applied.
and in the 90 days, if I'm recalling this right, was thrown on air to give those people who did not have it or were in the process of getting it a specified time whereby they would have that authorization, because if we don't have that, then you got an old, you got a condom guy area just sitting there waiting in limbo for somebody to get their ducks together. And we, last task force, we did agree with the 90 days for that reason. Because if somebody can't get it together, we wanted to get it back out to where the next qualified applicant could get that area and start using it.
Mr. Chairman, the problem with putting 90 days in statute is, if there really is a legitimate reason why that has not been met, and you know that those do come up, if you put 90 days in statute, you don't have any choice then to reject that, to reject that application. Because it's a shall, basically, or a must. So I just want you to be aware that you might be throwing out an application that for whatever reason didn't meet the 90 days, and then it's out and then start all over again, basically.
Nick?
Yeah, I would also, you know, like to point out that, you know, the agencies that do this permitting aren't necessarily tedious guys, and they could be dragged their feet, and you have no opportunity to use your guiding resource allotment, and you're out of luck, and they basically all they have to do is ignore you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Ken. Madam Chair is back.
I would propose deleting the 90 days, just that way a person, of course, like we do on other state leases and operations, have to have the permits in hand before they're allowed to apply. It doesn't make sense to issue areas to people that can't use them or utilize them. And if somebody wants to obtain an area or obtain a guide out there, like, they have to go through the steps to get that. So it seems logical to me that you should have to have permission to use the land and the permit before you're allowed to even apply. And so I thought that the 90-day thing was just an extra leniency thing, but it would be just as easy to delete that and just have the applicants have the permission in hand when they apply.
Can we have a comment from one of the federal officials here?
Madam Chair, this is Leo Keeler with the Forest Service again. Just through some general discussions with other agencies, I'd like to make the board aware that we do have a permitting process that does require time. Normally, we can get permits out within about 60 to 90 days. However, the tone of the conversation right now tends to imply that every guide in the state would be coming to the Forest Service asking for a permit, which we would have to process before they could apply for the state permit. If we received anything of that nature, we would put a freeze on any actions and say, wait till we finish our land use planning. So there's going to have to be some type of coordinated effort between the state and the federal to determine how that's going to be handled.
Yeah, I think that was one of the issues in D.C., is that the feds wanted to be at the end of the process, not at the beginning of the process. Nick?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's my concern, is that we get the horse in front of the cart here and not put something in there that's real, and you know, doesn't work for a guy that maybe has never operated in one of these areas where he needs a permit, and he's not going to get a permit unless he gets his UCU or whatever it is, and he can't get that unless he gets a permit.
Yeah, something else is, if we want the feds to trust in our system and trust in the fish, the state managing the fish and wildlife, then we need to go first to show them that our process is in order, and then have them be at the end of the process with their permitting, not at the beginning of the process. And plus, these federal permits cost money too. And so why should someone pay additional money to the feds before they know they pass all the steps in the state criteria, Ken? So I kind of like it the way we have it, with the feds at number 7, and they have to do all the state things first and then go to the feds at the end of the line. Pete?
We might just say in this case that they would have to have other permits as appropriate before they operated. In other words, before they operated their guide business on the land. And then, I mean, basically that gives them a year, because later on in here we're going to say if they don't use it within a year, they're going to lose it anyway. So at the worst, we would have the thing tied up for a season if that guy couldn't obtain all the proper permits.
You know, I think where the 90 days came too is we asked our federal officials that were there at the time, could they process these things, and how long would it take? And I believe the native corporations, where it was necessary, and the feds said, well, we could probably do these things in 90 days. And I think that's where the 90 days came in, because we didn't want this piece, this concession or this permit to be out there for a whole year and not be used. So we wanted to put some timelines on it. Steve?
We attorneys have a little good cause requirement a lot of times. That's kind of the language they throw into the rules. If you can't do something, you can show the court good cause why you couldn't. I think maybe we want to keep the 90 days in. Maybe we want to have a little proviso that says if you can't do it within 90 days and it wasn't your fault, you can show good cause to the department as to why. And if you say you mailed your application 90 days ago and they just haven't gone and processed them yet, maybe that's something that will avoid the harsh punishment of forfeiting whatever it is that you've got.
Having come into this discussion late, if there's someone who wants to make a motion to remove that time frame, that is in order. Motions are in order at any time in this discussion. Otherwise, we'll proceed. Ken, how do you feel about this? Gosh, it's hard not having you here.
Well, I think what the attorney just said is fine with me. I guess I think that a lot of these things are pretty complicated, and I think it would be a waste of time of the Commercial Services Board to process applications if the applicant wasn't serious. But I think that if the 90-day thing with good cause exemption or exception that Steve just mentioned seems fine with me. The other thing I'd like clarified is that...
Wait a minute, Ken. So you want, and does anyone disagree with a good cause safety net section on there saying 90 days unless there's cause for art? Right. Everybody is nodding their head. Yes, Ken, they agree with that good cause safety net on there. I beg pardon? For six and seven. For both six and seven. Go ahead, Ken. What's your next question?
Well, the other thing is I'm a little disturbed about the order again, but back on page 5, number 4, is that the Services Board has established, and I don't think this is necessarily in order, but anyway, they've already got a point system and a ranking of the individuals who have applied. So in the event that this other applicant, gets the award, but then fails to show good cause and fails to get the permits, is it understood or will it be put in there someplace that the awarding will automatically go to the next person in line who does have those things or can get them?
Next player points.
Understood.
Yeah, we're all saying it's understood. It's not written anywhere, but that would certainly make logical sense if we want to go on logic. Would you like to propose that that be added to this legislation?
I think it would be in rare form if we go on logic, and I would move that we do so.
All right. No one seeing. Ken is moving that we add that if an applicant for some reason can't meet his private landowner or federal landowner application process, that the award go to the next person down on the list. Is there any objection to that? Hearing no objection, Steve will add that to it. Ken, good point. Anything else on page 6? Steven.
I think we had to talk point number 9 because I think we're getting back into the weak legal link of the whole system here. And I think when a court looks at this system, they're going to look at two things, and those two things are going to be determine whether it stands or falls. One of them we've already talked about, which is the length of the permit. And the second one is number 9, which allows someone who has a permit to tack on or get priority for another period. The Osacek decision was pretty specific, but one of the problems with the old system was that it allowed the access to be based on seniority. And number 9 looks to me like seniority points, and I want to be convinced that I can convince the judge that we're not talking about seniority points here, but I can't think of any other way but to define it as seniority points.
Okay, but Stephen, the person that's there, the person that knows the resource, the person that has a stake in the resource, in the longevity of that resource, is the best manager.
Yes, but the court isn't going to say that that's...
But we're saying that good game management is our number one reason for doing this.
That's one issue.
Okay, it's one issue, that's right. But there's one reason why you... should count, and we've limited them. They'll only count once.
But by counting, excuse me, Madam Chair, by counting once, they're going to allow someone to turn a 10-year permit into a 20-year permit.
15-year.
Well, I think the first one is for 5, and every one after that is for 10.
But they only get points for one renewal.
But if someone comes in later in the system and gets a 10-year, they didn't participate
in
the first one,
that's
then they'll get a 20-year.
That's right.
And the 20-year is pretty much the lifetime of a guiding operation, probably, in my, the way I would understand it.
I hope that's not the case. I hope that's not the case.
Can anyone else give Stephen other reasons why renewal is a good idea for one shot? We're willing, I think last time, Stephen, when we went through this, we were willing to risk the gamble for a one-shot deal based on the good management of the resource. Plus, they tell me that a good curl takes 10 years to develop. Is that Paul and then Richard?
Well, it's basically a total game management system. Let's say, Steve, we give it to somebody for 5 years, okay? And I go ahead and get that. And I'm just going to roll in there for 5 years and have a heyday and walk away. Okay? And the way our system works out is that it's not going to be able to catch up to me by the time I'm done. And I'm not going to even apply the second time around. Unless there is an awarded deal with that person for using a good stewardship of his awarded area, unless there's something given to that individual, some kind of a carrot there that says, I'm not going to go in there and do that, which was occurring... has occurred in the past, and sometimes, unfortunately, is human nature. And I hate to say that there are people who will do this, but the fact is they will. So we had to have something in there that gave a carrot that said, look, if you're good, and you worked along this way, and you're a good steward of that situation, then you are going to get a leg up for the first go-around. Obviously, on the next go-around, hopefully the guy isn't, you know, it's going to work out. Because of the compromise, that on the second go around, he wasn't going to get a leg up.
Sharon?
Ken, and then Randall. Oh, Richard. Excuse me, Ken. Richard was first, then Ken, then Randall.
Paul, your comments make me think and wonder, is somebody who invests the time and effort to get a guide outfitter license and a master guide outfitter license going to, if I understand you correctly, throw away that 5 and 15 years experience used to acquire those licenses for a 5-year shot at an area? I wouldn't think the person would do that. My real point, though, was trying to address what the chair was asking Steve White, and can we look at this first-time applicant phrase in here in a way that these are new entrants to the system, which is one of the things that OCCHEC was trying to get this new legislation to address.
Ken?
Yeah, Madam Chairman, I think if I heard Steve right, it seems to me that you could eliminate his concern if on number 9 you said extra points can go to a first-time applicant with a good record, provided that that first-time applicant applied and received an area for 5 years or less. In other words, he was concerned that somebody that came into it later and automatically after the first go-around got a 10-year deal and then reapplied and would get extra points, so that would then basically kind of give him a leg up for 20 years, whereas the rest of the system is designed on 5-year or less things. So then a guy would be able to, then the only way that you would get extra points for experience would be the very first time, and then only on the provision that you had only held the area for 5 years or less, not 10 years.
Stephen?
That would be better. The two issues work, of course, together, both the length and the ability to get it on seniority. So what anybody challenging is going to look at is a worst-case scenario using both of them together. How long could somebody in a worst-case scenario go? And if it's 15 instead of 20, it just makes it easier for me to defend.
Actually, the very worst-case scenario is 20, because if the board determines that, for example, with the Rams and the 15 years, if they allow up to 15 years, which they can under the system, for a trophy animal that takes that long, and we give them a 5-year startup, then someone can effectively get 20, even under this system.
Randall?
I
don't see it either, Steve, but let's let Randall comment, and then I'm going to ask you to point that out, because I don't see where it fits. Go ahead, Randall.
Madam Chair, I just... I've heard this enough, and I feel like I have to respond to it. And we keep having the specter of persons who we have licensed as guide outfitters, who, if they don't have an opportunity to have an additional period of time in which to guide after the first five, are going to feel then that their only responsible action is to decimate the resource. And I really think that we ought to, if that's really how most people feel, then I think that's unfortunate. I don't think that's the case, but that's always a threat we get, and I think that we probably ought to have that clarified. And secondly, if that's how they feel, why wouldn't they do it at the end of their 10-year period? So, I mean, I don't think I'd make that argument, because I don't think it emboldens us, and it certainly doesn't make us look any better.
Any objections to adding to criteria number 9, or item number 9, on page 6, extra points the first-time applicant with good track record provided that applicant received an area for 5 years or less applies to renew? Any objections to that from around the table? No objections? Ken, we'll take... Oh, Matthew.
Madam Chair, on 9... I still have some problems along with Steve there. Seems to me that this would be on a seniority basis system where we're trying to give everybody equal access for the boundary or guiding area. You know, we got to try to put all applicants in the same order or have the same way system so everybody can have a chance to get in within the system or within that area in an equal basis. And how that comes around, I wouldn't know, but on this number 9, it would be a seniority for those other people that has already been out in there on the field.
Correct. Are you, you're objecting to that? You want to make a motion to delete number 9?
I don't know.
And have no renewal?
There must be some, sorry. there must be some way to give a very equal access chance, and maybe Steve got something along the line for some kind of thing.
What we're saying here is the person that's been there, the person that has gotten the first 5 years, they do have seniority points for getting there the first time, and we're going to give it to them once. Not into perpetuity, but just one shot at it. And that was the decision we made, and we'd have to vote to undo that decision, which is always in order if you wish to do that. Luke?
Madam Chairman, Matthew, on, as you know, this is one of 9 criteria that would be used, and the one right above there would give points to someone who has no area.
Chris, I completely agree with
you. Right, yeah. So what it would do is...
Balance.
Yeah, and then with it being, with that amendment that was made that Ken offered, that even makes it less significant. I mean, it gets it to the point where somebody may get 1 or 2 points, but it's certainly not going to, I don't think in most cases, is be the override. It will very seldom be any type of overriding factor, because you look back up at these other things, that's where the weight's going to be carried in whether or not somebody gets awarded an area.
Steven.
Of course, it's all going to come down to how you really weight the points.
That's right.
And that's yet to be determined, so we'll just have to see.
That's the key
right. Right.
Is that.
Nick?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that's really key, and it, you know, there's opportunity in this award criteria to weight those towards past users or to weight it towards newcomers. I mean, it's kind of hard to have experience and on-the-ground knowledge of an area if you've never been allowed to operate there. So I don't know what the answer is, but well, we sure do need to keep an eye on that.
Randall.
Madam Chair, the only other thing that I would say about this is, again, having some idea about how many guide outfitter units we may end up creating would assist me in deciding whether or not I'm really opposed to this. Because again, if we end up with a fairly low number where we're basically not going to have probably expanded the opportunities, then I'm more concerned about this. But if we have a greater number and we allow a significant number who are currently involved to have an area, then I'm not as concerned. And I think it's because I really do believe in the long run that we should have these be as long as possible for the reasons that have been stated before. But so I'm, Steve sort of would like me to make a motion here to change this. I'm probably not going to do that, but I do think that we ought to, it would be helpful if we had any idea what we're talking about in terms of numbers, because that would sort of alleviate some of my concern.
Okay. Let's look at it. You're trying to look at it very concretely. You're trying to get concrete reasons for supporting this.
Right.
Let's look at it from just a philosophical point of view.
Right.
Let's be abstract for a minute.
Sure.
What? Think about the job world. Think about people, how they're motivated, and how they perform their job.
No,
okay?
Madam Chair, I really, honestly, believe I wouldn't have trouble with 20 years. That's not my problem. I just think that our problem is we have a bizarre constitution, and we're trying to make a law that's going to fly past the Supreme Court. And I agree that adding extra points for having already had an area weakens our case. But I think I agree with you all. We ought to run a flagpole, and if it doesn't fly, it doesn't fly. But
I think on the economic point of view, the quality of the hunt, the quality of the game management, we have a case to argue, and if they rule against us, Jesus, you know, I mean...
Right.
But so I think it's worth our try to run that up and based on some sound logic that we put in this law and say that the integrity of the industry and the integrity of game management gives this one a sway to, in our favor, even though we all recognize it's a gray area. I don't think anybody here is saying it's not a gray area. We just think it's darker gray than Steve.
Well,
of course,
and I think
we don't have to argue with
it. And that's where I say,
we'll
if
be right
I had
there
a feeling,
behind you, though, saying, go,
right.
go, go.
If I had a feeling that we were going to have 800 areas instead of just 300, like we used to, 350 like we used to have, I'd feel a lot different because we'd have a lot more opportunity. And so that's where my point about how many areas we're going to have.
Yeah, I think, Stephen, you're the lawyer, but you'd have to do this whole thing on balance, the fact that we're having areas open every year, the fact that we are pushing for the newcomer to get into the system. I mean, on balance, this is a very little carrot to throw to the old boys.
Although the Sejak decision specifically talks about seniority. And if we want to make it for a 15-year system, I'd rather have them a 15-year permit than a 10-year permit and a 5-year seniority points allowing them for 5 more years. See what I'm saying? Because seniority is going to be a red flag to the court.
But the 5 years lets newcomers come in on a scheduled basis, and it tests everybody. You know, you give somebody an area for 15 years, and you may not know for the first 8 or 9 that they're really making a mess of that area in there and desecrating the wildlife. I mean, it just may happen that way. So I think the 5 years gives us the checks and balances on just checking out our system, making sure the areas are proper, making sure that it's working right, and so I think you argue that 5-10 split based on just checking out a brand new system. So. Richard?
Madam Chair, it seems to me we can also argue that this is not seniority necessarily in the context of the OC check, but rather a method that the task force is finding to improve the economic viability of the industry within the state.
Yeah, but remember, Stephen said that Osechek gave us lots of avenues. Economic viability of the industry wasn't one of them. And I had asked that question earlier because I was hoping we could utilize that for extending the time period. That's why I supported your motion. And he's telling us, and Steve told us that they didn't leave that door open for us. Stephen?
I guess two sides of the coin. On one side, I can see one of the justifications for what we just did as being we're setting up a system that has a staggered basis. It's kind of crazy. We've got some chaos. This is the one way to do it. So therefore, we're carving out this exception for this time. But I can also see, and this may never happen, but I can see someone saying, well, hey, if I really do have a leg up and I ask for 5 and I get 15, rather than if I ask for 10, so 10 years down the line, if someone sees that everybody is getting renewed, they may rather ask for 5 the first time because they may have some kind of more of a guarantee for the next 10, and that's a 15-year permit rather than I'll take 10 now, and then I won't get a chance on my next 10. So are we, as you said in the worst-case scenario, Stephen, are we giving everyone 15 years off the bat from now till eternity?
Matthew, did you have a comment?
Oh, no.
Madam Chairman, I do.
And Fanning.
Yeah. I think that the 5 years, if I remember the discussion about it, is pretty consistent with federal land management permits and other to prove that he has the ability and does fulfill on an annual basis all the terms and conditions of the permit, including several state reports that are required. It's also a time period under which number 3, number 4, and number 5 would work to his disadvantage if he did not comply with them, and they would be disadvantage points to an experienced operator that an unexperienced operator would not have that the possibility of that disadvantage. So really, it does not at all seem to me like it's a guaranteed 15-year deal. It's a situation where under a probationary period, you determine for yourself if it's economically viable. The game department determines if it's beneficial from a wildlife standpoint. Otherwise, it'll reduce seasons in that area. And you prove to the Commercial Services Board you do a good job, or you lose points in several different areas because of your experience.
For some reason, Ken, no one's disagreeing with you. Further comments on page 6. Nick.
Yes, I'm not sure if this is the appropriate place for this, but is it the point system that determines how many areas an individual can accumulate, or is there some place where there's a limit on that number that I haven't seen yet? Like, could a guy go out and have 6 or 7 of these areas if his points merited, or are we being restricted or going to be restricting on this to 1 or 2 or whatever it is?
Okay, yes. The way it's written up right now, that if a guy has more than one area and there are new people trying to get into the process, then the guy that already has an area for a certain species is going to lose points. There's going to be some deductions, some negative points on his application for an additional area. Just so, and that's another leg up for the new person coming in so that they've got a chance to get in there. That's the way it's right now.
So the way it stands now, it's all based on the individual's points in terms of what he is eligible for.
Right. Matthew.
Chairman, on point number 4, Fish and Wildlife Legal Compliance, is this the same way for the deducted points off if they don't comply with Fish and Wildlife? On this one, they get deducted for points, but on the other hand, it's just the feds that if they have any kind of violation for the last 3 to 5 years, they're not going to renew their license at all. Why are we making a special case with ours or the state?
State violation, and the feds have their own criteria for awarding their permit. See, so the feds would be under 6.
Okay. Just the way I see it, if a person gets some violation there out in the field, we're still going to live and continue with the system.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to that. The law that governs the guide outfitters, when we adopted the new law, it also says if you violated and have been convicted of a violation of the Fish and Game Statute, then you lose your license. So they're not even going to be eligible for these. So I don't think that's not going to be an issue, I don't think. You're not going to have people who've had Fish and Game violations having these areas.
Over $500 fines.
Right.
Representative Barr.
Yeah, on number 9 on the bottom of page 6, extra points the first time an applicant with a good record applies. Is that with respect to the initial 5-year period?
Yes, we've amended that. Nobody disagrees.
Okay. Thank you.
A7. Public hearing starts in 35 minutes. I know you all are anxiously anticipating that. Who receives the permit?
Page 11 of the memorandum.
Commercial Services Board reviews the applications and makes initial determinations. Commercial Service Board may allow applications to be revised. That's a loophole now. We want to know what the parameters are of that. That's a wide open area, I would think. Number 3, modified or revised applications received. commercial. Oh, I know. Never mind. I take back what I said about number two. You got to have that because of this process. The Commercial Service Board reviews and proposes final determination, and in case of ties, applicants may reach a resolution or a lottery or draw is employed. Pretty straightforward.
And just to clarify, number five, they're allowed to reach a resolution, and if they can't, a lottery or draw would be employed.
Do we have any interest? Do we care? Are we concerned about what may occur in the resolution process?
You want to know what happens privately?
No, I don't. But I guess my concern is...
duels aren't allowed anymore.
Right. I understand that. I guess my concern is... and I don't know that we want to get involved, but we are, in a sense, inviting an interesting problem, it seems to me, by saying this, in that, what if, for instance, two people come to some financial agreement about who does or doesn't get into an area, and then there's some, okay, I'll just make it, well, by the way, never mind.
Page 8. All right, Randall.
That's Randall, right.
This corresponds to page 12 of the memorandum. Until his animals become trophy animals, are we going to punish that person for doing what we allowed him to do? And how can we phrase this to make sure people don't decimate the last year?
I guess my feeling would be that while we don't give them points, extra points for good stewardship, if the department made a recommendation that they did an absolutely horrible job over the life of the 10-year cycle, that they ought to get negative points.
Can safe operations be expanded to include some kind of concern for the resource? It's unsafe to do that. I don't know. Do we want to stick in a temp number on a word criteria? Or stick it somewhere else? Maybe the floor could talk about that.
Couldn't we just say that in renewal process, the department comments on stewardship of area in relationship to game management? Something along those lines? Lou? You hated it.
No. Madam Chair, if the person is following all the regulations and you know, being a legal guide as well as a good conservationist and all that good stuff, I think that's enough. I don't think that we have to set it up for the department. What that would do is force the Department of Fish and Game to report, I mean, constantly on, you know, each of these people in the field. And I'd love to be able to tell you we had enough people in time to do that, you know, on a yearly review, but we don't. And I'd rather not force that onto our agency. If, however, on the other hand, we've got a real violator out there, we'll walk into the Commercial Services Board and make sure they understand it.
But, Representative Arwich, you might want to be thinking about this for the next round, and you can always add that amendment in, because I think it's a good idea. I think we should be able to do something.
I think it's a good idea in theory, but thinking about it, it's kind of a subjective determination as much as anything, and that's real difficult to quantify.
Back to page 8. Yes, sir. Okay. Thank you, sir, very much. Stay. Page 8. Stephen.
I think this might be the appropriate place to put in an ability for the state to revoke or somehow change a permit based on changes in the game management or the game populations in that area. It seems to me if the system is supposed to be serving the game management role, there would be more defendable if we could change the permits if, for example, the game was getting hammered too hard in an area or something else. I don't know whether that's implied in this system or whether when one gets a permit, they're entitled to that permit for the entire period, regardless of what happens to changes in game population.
Lou?
Madam Chair, what page were we on when I went to
the
I don't think that's necessary because we have emergency water authority and to shut down, which we do, areas when we think there's too much harvest or to prevent an over-harvest. In the Board of Game, the permits, again, what we're talking about here is authorization for a use. The control of those populations is still back on the Department of Fish and Game and the Board of Game, wildlife population.
Would you like it, though, if we referenced that section in their emergency closure powers in this legislation? Make a completer package for you?
Well, then you're referring us a board or an operations outside of this scheme that we're trying to defend. And all I'm saying is that if we're talking about a system that's supposed to talk about the